first live stream ever. So hello, everybody. Welcome to the first live stream of the Bitcoin Nova. I'm here with Larry Lepard,
author of The Big Print.
So you are a legendary investor. I am so honored to have you on the show. I have your book here behind me on the shelf.
Saw that. Thank you very much.
Right over here. Yes. Yeah, so thanks. You are the managing partner at Equity Management Associates, and you're a vocal advocate of Bitcoin. So thank you again for joining me. This is amazing to get to talk to you. I'm very honored. And I read your book. I also listened to the audiobook version. It was incredible.
Yeah, you did a good job.
Yeah.
He really did. Great choice.
I love how you, I heard you speak in another podcast about how you wanted to ignite sort of this anger a little bit. You know, you wanted people to see the truth. You wanted to explain it for people who don't understand. So I really love that about the book.
Thank you. Yeah, it's... Yeah, the mission is to try and get the more Americans and people worldwide, really, but I start from the American point of view, more people to understand what's been done to them, and then, you know, get them, make them aware of it, and then hopefully they'll get angry about it, and then hopefully they'll take action to solve it.
Yes.
We all know what that is. So yeah, that's why I wrote the book.
Yeah, and I love that you wrote the book too, because you were thinking, you know, people have all these thoughts about what's going on in the finance world and what governments are doing with money printing and inflation. And, you know, you have these ideas, but by writing the book, you are putting your words into history. Like, you're actually etching that into a part of history.
I hope so. I mean, that's, yeah, I thought about that for sure. I mean, it's, yeah, it's a story that needs to be told, and it wasn't being told. I mean, there are a lot of other great books that have done a very good job, but I kind of came at it from a different perspective, trying to tell more of my personal story and therefore maybe get people more involved in it. People don't always read, you know, textbooks or other books on Bitcoin, you know, and you notice I didn't put Bitcoin on the cover. I just made the cover orange.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people are kind of anti-Bitcoin. They don't really understand it. They lump it in with crypto. I've encountered a lot of that. And I try and debunk all of that. So.
Yeah, that's really great. And I love that you, you know, because people might see a Bitcoin cover and they think, you know, I don't understand it. I'm not going to read it just already because I just don't agree with it or something. But when you show that the US dollar is on the cover and the name of your book, The Big Print, it just draws people in. And
that's
I love how...
Yeah,
sure, no problem.
It always happens, Stacey, right after I start a recording or a live broadcast, my dog decides she has to go outside right then.
So sweet. What kind of dog do you have?
It's a West Highland Terrier.
Oh, cute.
It's hard to ignore her. She's very vocal when she has something she wants. So anyway, I mean, I tried to come at it. I mean, you know, the average American, the average citizen, they're being gaslit by the government, right? You know, greedy corporations, we didn't do it, it's not our fault, blah, blah, blah. And that's, those are all just lies. And so, you know, and I think people sense, a lot of people I know sense something's wrong. I mean, how can you not when you go to the supermarket and you see the food inflation? And so I think that, you know, too few people understand what's causing it. And that's why I wrote the book, you know, to try to explain in terms that they can understand that, you know, yeah, it is hard these days and it's wrong and it's broken and it's systematic and, you know, we've got to fix it. And so, you know, the first part of the book's kind of depressing, you know, about how broken it all is and it's designed to get people active and mad about it. The second part of the book is, hey, it's really optimistic that there's this great solution emerging and technology is going to carry us to a much better world where sound money is going to be the base layer and we're going to be, you know, things are going to be good. And that's what we have to look forward to. But, you know, we need to make the transition from here to there and it, you know, it's going to take a few years. It's not going to just happen overnight. So,
yeah, you know, it does have this, you know, you do have hope when you realize there's a solution.
Absolutely. I mean, Bitcoin changes you in that respect. I mean, you just get so much more positive and optimistic and you start thinking long term and taking care of, you know, physically eating better, working out. I mean, everything about it, when you think there's a bright future ahead, you want to stretch out, you know, your life and enjoy things. So,
yeah.
And sadly, you know, when it looks like there's no hope, you know, of course, the opposite's true. And even the beginning of the book, I show those charts on the deaths of despair. I mean, sadly, a lot of citizens have been very badly damaged by the economic system. And you know, that's not good for them. That's not good for their health. So,
Yeah, no, it's true. It's like people don't, they're just in this, stuck in this infinite loop of working too hard and struggling to get by. And they don't, like, I feel like people just, they're not looking forward to their future. They're not trying to take care of their bodies, and they don't have time to exercise and do things that are important to them. And I just feel like the beginning part of the book where you said it was depressing, it's very eye-opening though, because you speak about your father and your grandfather. No, it's okay.
Okay. Stuff going on. Yeah.
And it was, it really hit me too, hearing that, because it's a story that's been told over and over again throughout families and throughout generations, where, your grandfather had a furniture company, handcrafted furniture.
Handicraft, yeah.
Yeah. And it was crazy because they build up this confidence in, business owners and people that own companies, and the federal government and the interest rate policies and all of that. Once they lower the interest rates and make you feel like the economy is doing great, you are optimistic and you think, I need to grow this business. I'm so busy. I have to take out these loans, and you try to grow the business, and then it turns around and they raise the interest rates so hard.
They
rug pull you. Yes. For years, it's been happening.
Well, it happens over and over again, happened in .coms. And really it happened in 2008. I mean, everyone alive today, no doubt, had parents who went through the 2008 crisis, and a lot of people got really hurt. I mean, my sister lost her house. It's just, it's the Federal Reserve has been a very destructive force in American history. And, that's not the story they would tell you, of course. Jay Powell in his last press conference talked about how everything they do is in the interest of the American people. And that's just horseshit.
Yeah, it is. That's why when you mention the word gaslighting, like a lot of people even today don't really understand the word gaslighting. I always hear people say, what does that really actually mean? But that is a perfect example of what our government does, because they make you think that, this is just the way it is. Everything's fine. You're wrong about, they make you believe that you're crazy because you're thinking that these things are not right. And they're turning around and they're telling, assuring you that everything is fine. They can't have a forward outlook on what's happening with the economy because they're blinded by greed, so they're just, do what they have to do for themselves.
It's all just a big psyop. I mean, it's, and the people in power, the people in control, they've been lying to us for years and years and decades, and not just about the money, about other things too. I mean, they murdered the president, and the CIA murdered the president, and, what they very conveniently kind of, drew the lines through the media and other things to say that anybody who believed in that was a crazy wingnut conspiracy theorist, when in fact, all of the objective evidence just overwhelmingly points to that's what happened.
Right.
And so they try and make you think you're crazy when you point out the truth. And this goes on over and over again. I mean, when I was young, the Vietnam War got going, and it was all, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, when they claimed that one of our boats was attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin, which it wasn't. They made it up in order to escalate the war. So, there are hundreds of examples of this. And the beautiful thing though, Stacy, that I, point to in the book, and the optimistic piece of the book, is that, the internet technology is going to save us, right? I mean, the internet, I mean, heck, 10 years ago, you and I couldn't even have this conversation real time, different parts of the country, broadcasting out to hundreds of people, right? That just couldn't have even occurred. And now it is. And so, the New York Times and the mainstream media don't control the narrative anymore. Tucker Carlson is a participant, Joe Rogan is a participant, you're a participant, many other people are participants. And so, the internet has allowed people to realize how badly they've been gaslit, because people who are truth tellers are coming out and telling the truth. And so, I'm the most recent monetary truth teller, because I've seen this thing for, the benefit I brought in writing the book, I think. And the reason I kind of I felt like I was tapped on the shoulder and said, hey, you ought to write this. And the reason I did it is because I just thought, I've lived through this for a long time, 67 years old. I saw how all this went down. And I see a lot of young people in Bitcoin and sound money not really understanding the whole history of how we got to where we are. So I thought I would kind of try and explain that and just lay it out very clearly. Look, this has been a long campaign on the part of the elite and the centralized systems, including the government and the top people at the top, to, screw the common person, period.
Yeah.
And they've done a good job of it, because look at the top 1% now owns 92% of the wealth, and we've got oligarchs running the country. So, it's just not right. And we, you know, but if we live in a representative democracy, which you do, arguably quite a broken one, but nevertheless, you know, enough voices, enough protest, enough, you know, work on our part, I still am optimistic and believe that we can and will overcome the system that they've got in place.
Yeah, well,
you know, people aren't stupid.
Yes. And of course, they're not stupid because of what you said, because of technology, the way it's transforming the landscape now and allowing this truth to be told. And, you know, people that they used to be able to control narratives and hide, you know, ideas that they called conspiracy theories, and instead they were actually just conspiracies. But it's like, you think about how government just moves so slow, but they used to be in such control for such a long time. But with the advances in technology, they move too slow, and technology moves too fast, and they can't outrun it. You know,
that's exactly right. Yeah, and mm-hmm. they want it. You know, they'd love to kill Bitcoin, but they can't. Right. You know, and they'd love to shut down all these voices, but they can't. I mean, they're mm-hmm. you know, they're trying to attack free speech, but guess what? It's going to just keep coming back to get them. And so they're losing, which is a really beautiful thing, in my opinion. I mean, it's right. really fun to watch these people lose and scramble, and you know, they're getting more and more desperate, and we're just going to bury them in the dustbin of history.
I love it, and I love that. I think of you as like you're a rebel in that way too, because you, like we have this community on X that's called the Paranoid Bitcoin Anarchists, but it's I feel like it's like the people that think of us as paranoid and anarchists, but I think that we think of it because regular people look at people that understand Bitcoin and they think you are just paranoid, but it's like, no, I actually am just seeing the truth.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And I feel like you have that, that fire in you, you have that anger about what happened in the past and living through financial, I mean, you worked in finance for all these years, you know, you've seen what goes on. So it's like for you to come out and write this book and tell your story and actually explain it in a way that people that are told what to believe, you know, for them to understand the truth, it's very important for people to just open their eyes.
That's really why I did it. I mean, I saw, you know, I recall early last year, 2024, the election cycle. I recall seeing some conversation and debate or something on one of the mainstream media programs. And, you know, you had blue team yelling at red team and red team yelling. I mean, they were arguing about all kinds of stuff that, in my opinion, was just, it's not relevant. It was stupid stuff. And nobody was talking about the really underlying problem that's caused everybody to be so angry. I mean, I think you have to admit that there are a lot of people who are hurting in this society today economically, and that hurt is leading to a lot of political anger on both sides. And so, and to me, it's not really the politics that are causing all this. It's the underlying money that's causing all this. I mean, if people are living well and getting better and they see their lifestyle improving over time, they tend to be pretty happy mm-hmm. and not really, they don't want to go out and get into political arguments. But if things are getting worse, they start pointing fingers and looking for people to blame. And that's why it's so nasty out there right now. And so, you know, I just felt like somebody's got to explain to everybody that this isn't really, this political stuff is really driven by the underlying economic stuff mm-hmm. that's making life harder. And that's not some mystery. That's not, you know, as mm-hmm. one side says, that's not greedy corporations. That's the Federal Reserve and the money printing. And, mm-hmm. you know, the cotillionaires and the banks and the way they've set the whole system up. So that, you know, if you're at the top, hey, you like inflation. It works great for you. You buy, you know, you buy things, you lever them up, they go up in value. Your cost of capital is cheap, et cetera. You get ahead in the world. You know, if you're you and me or anybody else, you know, if you want to borrow money, well, you got to pay the credit card company 25%, which is just, mm-hmm. it's, you know, that would have been usury in the old days. Of course, all the usury laws have been gutted. So, it's a very, very, very unfair system. If you go back to the Constitution, the notion of the Constitution of the United States, which made it such a wonderful country and took us to the top of the world post-World War II, you know, it was kind of equal justice under law and fairness. Now, we didn't always live up to it. There are a lot of things the country did wrong, you know, the treatment of the Indians, the, you know, slaves. I mean, all this stuff. We have a lot of black marks in our history, but we're evolving in the correct direction. And, you know, but this monetary thing, we never really solved this. This evolved in the wrong direction. And it's gotten much worse. And
it's
that's
like
why.
They escaped. Like people always talk about how they escaped so they could start a new country and have different rules and not be oppressed and be free. And instead,
Right.
they just built the same system that was that they escaped from in the first place.
Yeah, it wasn't quite the same because we don't have royalty, although effectively oligarchs have become like royalty, but
Yeah.
it was a better system. There was, you know, there was rule of law.
For a
I mean,
while, yeah.
Yeah, we in theory, I mean, look, I think the founding documents of the Constitution are just fabulous things. I
Yes.
mean, it's just kind of amazing what they did with this country. And yet, you know, like so many things, and this is the fourth turning cycle, like so many things, eventually, you know, a system gets older, corrupt, broken. And as I say in the book, you get to the point where you have, quote unquote, diseconomies of scale. You know, in the beginning, economy of scale, which is making things big so that they're more efficient, that actually made sense. I mean, Henry Ford kind of kicked that off with the assembly line, right? You know, it was a lot better than putting together cars one car at a time by hand. And it made cars cheaper and everybody got a car. But eventually systems get so big that they you know, they're unwieldy and the people at the top don't manage them correctly. And then you have an enormous country that's a system, you know, like Germany, and some idiot madman gets control of it and decides he wants to kill all the Jews, you know? And so that's a diseconomy of scale. I think that got, we reached peak diseconomy, peak scale and big organizations at right at the end, right at World War II. Because, I mean, we killed 40 plus million people, maybe 50 or 60 in that war. And that was the last fourth turning. And then since that time, you know, things got better. We had a first turning. We had a lot of economic growth. But the, you know, the flaws in the monetary system have become really apparent since, you know, World War II and more particularly even since 71. I mean, another chart in the book that it's one of my favorite charts that I refer to a lot is the one where it just shows inflation over a very long period of time and how in 1971, it just kind of inflects and goes straight up. And,
yeah.
you know, Nixon taking us off the gold standard was a very, very bad thing.
Yeah.
But, and that started where we are, the path that got us to where we are today.
Exactly. Yes. And that's why I love when you mentioned before that it evolved, it turned into this thing. It wasn't
right.
starting off this
started
way.
Started off a lot better. Yeah.
Yeah. And can you explain the fourth turning to people that don't understand?
Sure. Yeah. And I highly recommend everybody who's read my book or is interested in this subject to read this book. It's a book it's written quite some time ago now. It was written by Howe and Strauss. They're two social scientists.
Mm-hmm.
The model is pretty simple. It basically studies history of a lot of societies. And what it shows is that you have kind of these 80-year cycles. Each 80-year cycle is broken up into four 20-year cycles. And what it posits, the big picture of what it posits is that every 80 years, the societal rules get kind of old and broken. And then you go through a crisis period. And those rules get fixed and a new birth occurs and you're kind of in a first turning and, you know, society grows and moves forward. And so we're in what I consider to be a fourth turning that started in 2008 with the great financial crisis. And the one prior to this, about 80 years prior to that, was World War II and the Great Depression. The one prior to that was the Civil War, the U.S. Civil War. And that was about 80 years prior to World War II. And then the one prior to that was the U.S. Revolution in 76 to 79. And think about what each of those events had in common. I mean, America, you know, the world, and these happened in other countries too, but let's stick to America. America and the world was a certain way before the American Revolution. You know, we were colonies of Britain and they could tell us what to do. And we had a revolution and things were different. You know, we're now the new America with a constitution. Okay, great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, America, you know, and that went along for quite some time. And then, you know, eventually the issue of slavery became a defining issue and states' rights and federal rights and so forth. And that led to the Civil War. And so America was a certain way before the Civil War and then it was different after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And then it recovered and we grew and we did pretty well. And we had the Industrial Revolution and, you know, things got really good in terms of, you know, we had a lot of deflation and lifestyles, living standards went up enormously. I mean, we went from living in outhouses to having plumbing and electricity and cars and all that stuff, you know, in the early 1900s. You know, that all led up to the culmination of the crisis, which was, you know, the crisis of fascism and you know, the diseconomies of scale in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we had to go out and fight and die to prove that, you know, democracy was better than fascism. And that, you know, that was an existential moment, but we solved it. And, you know, we're in one of those now, in my opinion, and the issue is this monetary issue. And what happened is, you know, the money changers all figured out how to game the system in their favor, and they've done it. You know, they've done it since, you know, since 1946, and they've particularly done it since 1971. And now they've done it to such a degree that it's setting up to implode, that it just, you can't continue. I mean, the book shows, I mean, in the chapter that was inspired by Lynn Alden's meme, you know, nothing stops this train. You know, the debt is just getting so out of control, and the deficits are so out of control. And, you know, as Hayek says, you know, there's only one way of resolving, you know, these kind of a credit bubble, and that's either through stop printing or a complete collapse. And, you know, we may get a little bit of both, but I mean, we're kind of at that crisis stage. I mean, it's funny, I titled the book The Big Print.
That's what I was going to get to next.
Yeah. Well, so we've really had two big prints, right? We had one in 2008, you know, when Bernanke took the balance sheet from, you know, $800 or $900 billion up to, I think it peaked around $4 trillion. But over, you know, over a course of 3 or 4 years, actually more than that. And then we had another big print in, you know, with COVID. And of course, that one was bigger and happened faster. You know, they printed, you know, $5 to $7 trillion, took the balance sheet from, it had been reduced down to about 3. They took it up to 9. Of course, now it's been reduced down to about 7. But, you know, and my view is,
balance sheet.
What's that?
Fed
balance sheet. Yeah, which is a proxy for the money supply. And they're very tightly correlated. They're not perfectly correlated because there's also fractional reserve lending. But the point is that, you know, the underlying problem that Lynn has pointed out with her meme of nothing stops this train and that's going on is that you just can't grow GDP at a rate faster than, or I'm sorry, grow debt at a rate faster than you're growing GDP without there eventually, that gap eventually causing a problem, which either means the debt has to collapse and be declared worthless, or you have to inflate GDP massively to get it back into balance. And people, a lot of people in other pods and others have asked me, and they say, well, okay, yeah, great, Larry, but you've been saying this for a while, and why now? And I don't know that it's now, by the way, this next big print. I mean, it could be in 6 months, but I'm pretty sure, you know, going out, it could be in 5 years. I'm pretty sure it's probably within a year or two.
Well, but the thing is, you know, like how you said, like that meme about that, and it also reminds me of the meme from The Big Short where, you know, Steve Carell's character says it's a bubble, you know, so it's like we have this credit bubble and it's about to burst. And I feel like even though we haven't had a actual big print, you know, do you feel like in the last 4 years, I heard a stat that since COVID, there's been another $14 trillion added to the national debt, 12 or 14 trillion.
Right.
So even though we technically haven't had this obvious big print, there's it's like literally growing every year.
Correct.
You know, so it's happening already, but something's going to literally break. It's going to be that bubble that's going to burst. And it's like the fact that it's looming so hard and the fact that
you're right on target. I mean, you're right on target because what we've seen in the past is these things happen in nonlinear fashion. You know, in 08, it created a lot of debt and debt to GDP got to be very, very high and the leverage ratios got to be very, very high. And then something broke. And then, of course, you know, they had the choice of either let all the debt reset to a lower level and have a very significant economic downturn, which they chose not to do, you know, prosecute the people who had taken on the debt and who, you know, been criminals in the way they'd handled the financial system, or, you know, print to bail them out and make them all whole, let them, you know, get paid out at par and, you know, got $20 billion of bonuses, which is enormously unfair, while everyone else who'd been sucked into the bubble, you know, like my grandfather was in 1929, you know, they all lost their houses, right? Because they bought houses that were too expensive, used too much leverage, and the downturn, they got wiped. Many of them got wiped out. And I know a lot of people were really damaged by that bubble. So yes, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's coming. You know,
they bail out the people that were irresponsible in the first place in order to not cause a systematic, you know, effect throughout the global markets. You know, so they think that we don't have another choice. We can't just let people fail because everything is so interconnected with like every company being involved with every other company, and it could cause a global catastrophe. So they think, well, you know, we have to do this. But in the meantime, you're hurting everyday Americans, which the majority, I think, of Americans are middle class. Like you have a small percentage at the top, a small percentage at the bottom, but a huge chunk of it is middle class. And every single day they're working harder. So when this print happens, anytime these big prints have happened, anytime they continue printing, it's like our, you know, our savings is depleted in how much, you know, you think you have savings, but it's lost 40% of its purchasing power.
Yeah, you lost 40% of your purchasing power in the COVID thing. I mean, you're exactly right. In order to save the system, and then by definition, the people who are at the top of the system they print money that makes all the rest of us suffer. So everyone thinks, you know, they've said, you know, and I've heard people say Bernanke's a genius. He saved the system. But you know, they don't think about the other costs. And the other cost is, yes, he saved the system, but we pay higher prices for everything in order to have provided that saving. And the people who benefited from that, are the people at the top.
Yeah.
You know, massively. And that's why the wealth inequality has gotten so large.
And that's why it's good that the second half of the book, when you talk about this optimism, when you talk about there actually being a solution, instead of people thinking, well, this is the way the world is, I guess we just have to like play by these people's rules. There isn't, that's not the way it is. That's not the way it's turning out to be.
Exactly. And that's, I think, you know, the second half of the book is the fun part of the book, because the first half of the book kind of details, you know, this stuff, and you could read it and you could get depressed. But I think, you know, more likely what a lot of people are likely to do is, you know, the book is written as problem and solution, right? And so, and the first half, I had to write the first half, because if you don't understand the problem, you can't think about the solution.
Right.
And the first half was designed to wake people up to the problem so that they then come to the correct conclusion about the solution. And right. Yes, the solution is extremely optimistic. I mean, it's going to get so much better. We're going to solve it. In fact, I did a podcast yesterday with a gentleman, a really fun guy, who was Argentinian.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw
it. I saw some of it. Yes.
Yeah, neat guy. And he lived through the hyperinflation in Argentina in 1990 and 91. He was a teenager when it occurred. Oh, and he said, I recall my mom, she'd get paid. She'd rush to the supermarket to buy the food before the prices went up. Mm-hmm. He said it was really traumatic and dramatic. A lot of people lost a lot of money. It was very painful. And then one day the currency totally failed. It was worthless. And the Argentinian government came back and said, okay, well, we're going to back the peso by using the dollar. Now, dollar's somewhat flawed, but it was a whole lot better than the peso. It wasn't getting printed in the same way. And he said it was really amazing, because within a year or two, things got so much better. Everything returned to normal. And so we can all look at this and say, and decry how bad it is. And it is bad. It's unfair. It's broken. But let's not forget that this is not an unsolvable problem. And if we don't get into some kind of war where we kill a lot of people, like the last fourth turning, you know, this is all that's broken here is the money. Yeah. And so all we really need to fix is the money. So if we fix the money, things will get better, you know?
Right. And I think that's why it's interesting when you call the book The Big Print. It's also, it feels like we're also living through the big distract, because when you think about, how, you know, government prior to 2024, you know, Bitcoin had not been in the stock market. Now there are so many companies that have a stock of Bitcoin. And prior to that, it was always, you know, not talking about Bitcoin in a positive way in media. And also it was just trying to distract people from what is really something that is growing and actually could fix problems. So like, I think that so many Americans are, they misunderstand the fact that when they think of Bitcoin, they think of it as FTX and FTX collapse, and they think of that Sam Bankman-Fried guy. And I think that was pushed into our mind, or not into Americans' minds, to say like, oh, don't get that Bitcoin stuff, because it's connected to that person who the exchange collapsed. And I feel like they fed people that so hardcore, you know, that it feels like when you talk to any person who doesn't understand Bitcoin, that's the first thing they think of.
Absolutely.
And it's like, why was that shoved into people's minds so much?
From a conspiracy point of view, you could think the powers that be, you know, almost had to create somebody like a Sam Bankman-Fried. Maybe it's true. I don't know. I think he was just a bad actor and a bad guy. But you raise a really great point. And I mean, you read the book. I hope you agree. I really tried to attack that heavily, because, I mean, I've been in Bitcoin since 2013 or 14. And so I try to orange pill, you know, friends, neighbors, anybody, just because I want to see them protect themselves and benefit financially from it. And the two biggest objections are always, you know, and particularly from gold people, oh, that's all fraud. You know, look at Sam Bankman-Fried, all these cryptos, you can just print them up. Bitcoin's great, but there are a million of them. You know, there's going to be another one. And they don't understand proof of work or the mining, or they don't understand any of the stuff that makes Bitcoin different and unique, you know, the difficulty adjustment, all that stuff. They don't get that. Mm-hmm. But so I have to say, look, guys, you got to understand there are all these fake things, and then there's this one real thing, and they're different. And so that's point one. The other objection I countered a lot, and you'll appreciate this, I'm sure, as well, is that, you know, the people say, well, yeah, I get it. It's a libertarian dream. It's sound money. The government can't print it. It's like digital gold. But There's no way they're going to let that work, Larry. They're going to shut that down. They're going to tax the hell out of it. They're going to try and go. Well, and then January, you know, last year they approved the ETF, and I have to admit, even I was like, wow, that's really great. I wasn't sure they were going to do it, and they did it. And then, of course, now this year we've got a new president, new administration that created a strategy. I mean, so thus far in the last year, the government response to Bitcoin has been fantastic. And now, it may not always be this way because, you know, if blue team wins, you know, some future election, maybe they'll go back the other direction. But the point I'm making is, you know, the objective point that a lot of my friends had, which is the government will never allow it. Well, that's kind of gone away. I mean, it's the government is allowing it. The government has a strategic Bitcoin reserve. The government has allowed the ETFs. I mean, and, you know, you've also seen, and you got to watch the big money. You've also seen the big money make shifts. I mean, to me, it's enormously important that a guy like Larry Fink, who runs BlackRock, who was kind of a fiat lord and a fiat master, who originally was very negative on Bitcoin, shat all over it. You know, eventually he's a smart man. And so eventually he did the work and he thought it through. And I think he came to this conclusion. I think he looked at it and said, you know what? This is going to work. And I've got to either decide, am I going to embrace this and try and make money off it and have it be part of my strategy? Or am I going to, you know, continue to shit on it and not play in that game? And of course, that's what the guy who ran Vanguard did, and he lost his job. And Fink embraced it. And so I give him a lot of credit that he actually kind of figured it out and went in the right direction. Cool. And by the way, you know, they're the largest money manager in the world.
Yes.
I mean, that's significant. So, you know, and guys like Ray Dalio, one of the largest hedge funds in the world, he now gets it. I mean, So we're seeing growing acceptance that this really is digital gold.
For me, I got into Bitcoin in 2020, and I feel like they probably followed the same. A lot of people, like, I didn't either hear about it prior to 2020. And then once I did hear about it, I thought it was just like every other crypto, which when you understand that every other crypto is a technology and Bitcoin is a protocol, you understand that it's different because it's like how the internet is a protocol and the internet decentralization.
Nobody controls it. It's fair for everybody. There's no free mind. There's no, I mean, look, if your cryptocurrency has a CEO, you know, you don't want it.
Right.
There is no CEO of Bitcoin.
Yes. And there's so many reasons. There's a bunch, and that's why it takes some time to learn about it, but it's literally not just a technology. It's so different. And I think that the people that argue that government will never allow it, there's still people that say that. But if you think about it, if they do say like, okay, we're going to start taxing Bitcoin where other countries are not, then once you see that your wealth and your, you know, rises a significant amount, you're just going to say, well, I'll go live in that country instead. I'm just going to get out of here.
That's exactly right. So you get game theory on countries, and you know, we're starting to see nation state FOMO where, you know, I'm sure, look, when the U.S. announced they were going to form a strategic Bitcoin reserve, even though they didn't say they're going to add to the coins they have, you know, every other country in the world had to take note of that and go, huh, what should we do about this? You know? And so, you know, it really, we all know this, but maybe some of the people listening don't. I mean, it's just, it's such an amazing technological innovation. I mean, it's almost God-given. And you know, humankind has lived for thousands of years. We've never had a money that didn't debase over time. I mean, gold was great, but it still got debased. I mean, we mine 1.7% of the, you know, the existing supply every year. And that, do the math on that, it tells you that in 40 some odd years, you know, the supply will double. And so even with gold, you had monetary dilution. Here we actually have a technological thing driven by computers, driven by technology, which is going to save us, that has zero monetary dilution. That's, I don't think, you know, it's like, you know, when new inventions come along, I mean, I saw this myself with the internet, right? When new inventions come along, it's very hard to know how big and important the impact is going to be, right? I mean, I was an early investor in the internet. I really believed in it, and I knew it was going to be important. I mean, you know, somebody said to me, you can send email to people anywhere in the world for free. I was just like, wow, that's going to be powerful. And of course, Paul Krugman's reaction was, well, people just don't have that much to say to each other. And I was kind of like, what are you talking about? I mean, if you make it free, they're going to communicate on the internet. But I, you know, in 2000, I mean, could I foresee Amazon, or could I foresee Google, or could I foresee eBay, or, I mean, I just couldn't foresee all these use cases. You know, could I foresee that you and I would be talking halfway across the country real time with video? you know, and broadcasting it. And I couldn't foresee any of those things, you know, because they just, the technologies didn't exist and they were in the process of developing. And I think it's important to kind of think of Bitcoin in those terms. I mean, you know, it's hard for us to foresee how important this is going to be, but I think you're going to look back and it's going to be like, wow, that was a really important invention.
Yeah, because we're living through what before was the Industrial Revolution. It's like the technology revolution, you know, and we couldn't imagine what that would do to shape our worlds around us. And we can't imagine exponential growth now that, you know, technology is.
Well, and now, you know, the most recent thing is AI. I mean, look at what that's going to do. I mean, it's just, I mean, the rate of change. And it's fun when you go back and you look at history. I mean, I talk about in the book, both my grandparents, I mean, they both grew up. They didn't have indoor plumbing when they were born. You know, and by the end of their lives, I mean, they were flying on jet and, you know, back when they were born, the Wright brothers hadn't flown yet. They were just about to, you know, and by the end of their lives, they were taking, you know, jet trips around the world.
And I mean, I have some ideas about AI and how it's going to shape our world going forward. But what are your thoughts about how some people, they have that same fear that they think, oh, with AI and robots, no one's going to have a job anymore. It's going to destroy everything. But it's like, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, every single technology has created more jobs. They're just different. You know, I mean, the book talks about this. The Luddites were convinced that having weaving machines was going to put all the weavers out of business. So Ned Ludd's followers ran around England smashing the weaving machines. Well, you know, guess what? When you can weave cloth much more quickly, you know, the people who are weaving the cloth, they have free time to go do something else. And they'll do something else, you know, so there's always, you know, to be anti-technology, anti-productivity, anti-development.
Yeah,
it's just very wrong and very backward thinking.
I mean, yeah, when you have a
embrace it, you know.
Yes, when you have a technology that increases labor and productivity, then you have, you know, a deflationary force, where instead of inflation, you have prices going down, you have things costing less, and it could give people again that hope, because now you're not spending every single hour and have no time for your kids and your family, no time to take care of yourself and your body, and have a live till you're an older age and feel healthy. You know, you could actually take this extra time that you have now because there is a deflationary force happening in the world.
Correct. That's exactly right. And let's not, you know, let's not totally make complete lightness of it. I mean, you know, there is change. I mean, when things get automated, the people who used to do it by hand before, they do lose their jobs. I mean, you know, the buggy whip manufacturers, you know, all went bankrupt when the automobile came along. But you know, that's the process of productivity growth and creative destruction. And, you know, and that's capitalism by definition. And, you know, those people who are making buggy whips obviously found jobs doing something that was better, that was more useful.
I heard, I don't know what you think about this, because I feel like I had seen, again, back when I got orange pilled, I had seen this documentary called The Social Dilemma, and it was about how, like the most important resource being mined besides Bitcoin is human attention. So it's like this, it creates this new creator economy where people can spend more time being creative and actually doing things that normally they wouldn't have time to do that AI can't do because they need this, you know, humans to kind of have the creativity and the, you know, to come up with ideas. And, you know, that's where AI kind of learns from us, you know? So it's like, we would have more time.
What you're touching on is the issue that the only thing scarcer than Bitcoin is human time. I mean, we all have a fixed life. We all have a fixed lifetime, fixed lifespan, and that's that. And so that's even scarcer than Bitcoin. And yes, I mean, human attention is ultimately be extremely valuable. It's already valuable. I mean, look at how people online, you know, influencers monetize eyeballs. You know, they, you know, where people spend their time has value. Yes. I mean, it's a lot of these online apps, you know, I mean, we are the product. You know?
There's, you know, people make money off of what you do online. And I think eventually with the decentralization that's happening and the shift with AI and the shift with, you know, people being a more, you know, they own their time, they own their Bitcoin, they own, you know, so I think in the future, it'll be more of a world where people get monetized for their attention, and also, and that could be like a way that you get paid because of the things.
Yeah, the whole notion of micropayments is very fascinating to me. That, you know, we could all, I mean, once the Lightning Network is fully developed, we could all be, you know, you see something, you like it. I mean, it, you send a few sats that way. I mean, it's to me, I think it's a powerful idea that'll probably take hold over the years. But
yeah,
you know, we're still so early in this whole process, and it's difficult to see how. I mean, what I described with the internet. Remember, we're 25 years into the internet. I kind of consider real internet adoption to have started at 2000. I mean, it came out in 90. Well, it became more prevalent in 95 when I was investing in it in 93. But in 2000, about half the country had an internet hookup mm-hmm. of some kind. And that was when broadband really started to come in. You didn't have to do that dial-up thing where you had to put a phone and a modem and all that. And also that was, by that time, most people had a Windows, had a graphical user interface, and you had the Netscape browser was available. So we're now 25 years deep in the internet. And I kind of think of Bitcoin, although it's been around for 16 years, I kind of think like the first, I don't know, you know, they don't all count. I mean, you didn't even have, you know, a public exchange to trade it on. Well, you had Mt. Gox, which failed, but you didn't, you know, Netscape, or I mean, Coinbase didn't go public until 2013. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the first 6 or 7 years, I mean, for a while, it didn't even have any value until the pizza transaction. So we're, you know, if you kind of take away the first 6 or 7 years, you know, what are we now? Maybe 9 years, 8, 9 years deep into the development of Bitcoin. I mean, we got a long way to go until this thing gets more broadly accepted. I mean, the book has some good charts on that show adoption of other technologies in the curve.
Yeah,
and I'm with Michael Saylor on this. He thinks we're kind of right at the inflection point on the curve where it's going to really accelerate. And I agree with him.
I feel like
it's hard to find somebody now who's not at least aware of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. They may not have bought it. They may think it's a scam. They may, you know, they have a negative, but you can't. I mean, 5 years ago, you know, I'd say Bitcoin and people say, what?
Yeah.
People didn't even know what it was. You know, so.
But now when they do know what it is, they have the wrong idea about it.
Oh, that's right. But that's why you do what you do. That's why I do what I do. That's why, you know, we're going to flood the zone. And the price is going to keep going up. They're not going to be able to ignore it. I mean, they're just going to, you know, eventually say, oh, God damn it. I'm even seeing guys that, I mean, and I've seen this progression with everybody. And I mean, Max Kaiser saw it with me. I mean, originally I had a hard time getting off gold to go to Bitcoin.
Right.
And Max just kept saying to me, you'll get there. Just keep going. You'll get there. And he was right.
You know? And Max Kaiser, like knowing that he bought it at what, like a dollar?
Oh, a dollar, $2. I know. I had lunch with him. In the Middle East when he was, you know, he wrote the foreword of the book, which I'm eternally grateful for. I mean, he's such a great guy. And it was a really good foreword. And, you know, he said to me, he said, yeah, you know, I was buying it $2. I'm sitting there thinking to myself, God damn it. Trace Meyer bought it 50 cents. You know? So we all feel like we paid too much, Stacey.
Right. But that's the thing. When everyone feels like they paid too much, and anyone listening that doesn't understand, it's like we are, like, Bitcoin is a finite supply asset. It's like it's the only thing in the world that's like this.
We've never had something like this before. That's what's so unique.
Yeah.
And that's why, that's right. You can't pay too much for it.
Yeah.
I mean, I love the interview that Saylor had with that Laura woman where he just said, it's going up forever, Laura.
I know.
I love that because. And most people can't understand that. I mean, TradFi people especially. I have a lot of TradFi friends who even kind of get it and maybe want to own it. They're having a really hard time. They're like, Larry, you bought it at $10,000. You're asking me to pay $100? I can't do that. And I'm like, okay, but, you know, what if I told you in 5 to 7 years it's going to be $1 million and you could now buy it at $100? I mean, you know, you can't look backwards. You got to look forward to where it's going.
Especially when you think about the 1%, I think they're, well, right now we're around 98%. I think in the next 10 years, we're getting to 99% of the total supply being available.
Oh yeah, there's not much more to come. I mean, right now that stock to flow is half the rate of gold. We're adding 0.8% per year to the supply. And of course, in the next halving, that'll go to 4 and then 0.4 and then 0.2. So yeah, there's not much new Bitcoin coming into the market.
It's going to keep shrinking so infinitely, like so tiny, small. By the end of it, by the year 2140, it's going to be down to the last Satoshi, which is 1 out of 100,000.
100 million.
Bitcoin. So you're going to be down to the last Satoshi, which I describe it as like the pennies of Bitcoin, you know, for people that just don't know what Satoshis are.
Right, exactly.
But it's going to come down to that. So the last 1% will take till the year 2140 to finish, and that is the total supply. So we are literally at these points where the remaining supply is trickling into the system as the demand is rising.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, actually, I should point out, too, there are two things that are limited. I mean, and this is important to understand. One is the supply of Bitcoin. The other is block space.
Yes.
I mean, I don't think there's going to be another set of block wars. I don't think we're ever going to go to larger blocks. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that all of us today can still do on-chain transaction, I mean, we'll tell our grandkids about this because, you know, on-chain transactions will become enormously expensive in the future as the value of the coin gets much, much higher and the subsidy, the block subsidy gets much, much lower. But we won't need to do on-chain transactions because layer two and you know, whether it's Lightning or some alternative layer will be used for the more common transactions, and the chain itself will just be used for the super solid store of value, you know, application.
Yeah. So. Well, and that's the great thing when people had this, like the whole block size war thing is crazy because people were afraid that, you know, Bitcoin was getting overloaded and, oh, we need to increase these block size, and they lost that war, you know, that happened. But it's like nobody even pictured at that time that things would be built on top of Bitcoin instead of trying to create alternative cryptocurrencies and all these other things. You don't need that as long as you have a layer two and a layer three and things built on top of it. So it's like, that's why Lightning is important. And I even heard from Bevan Waite from Jan3. He was talking about the Aqua wallet, how they have where it could be a larger than, because Lightning, you could send, you know, smaller amounts, like to buy a coffee or buy a sandwich. But, you know, you could use this other like layer that's that Aqua wallet has, that it's a larger amount than Lightning, but not like on-chain transactions where it would become expensive.
Right. Yeah. No, I know there are solutions emerging. Yeah. Cause the liquidity in Lightning for some time was relatively modest. When I know I tried to send some multi-$1,000 transactions and it didn't really work very well, if at all. So yeah, and this reminds me of the internet too. I mean, there were a lot of clunky things about the internet in the early days, and, you know, I mean, leave it to technologists to sort this stuff out. You know, there's a huge reward for the people who provide the solutions. And so, so those solutions are coming. We just, you know, we got to give them time to work through and provide them to us.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, the solutions, you know, there's always people building and they're always creating, but it's like Bitcoin is the bedrock. It's the protocol. It's the internet of a new financial.
That's exactly right. It's like TCP/IP, but for money. And by the way, money is actually bigger than information. I mean, it touches almost everything. So.
And yeah, go ahead.
No, that's fine.
Okay. So I even like one other thought I had, I wanted to know what you think about it too, but I felt like AI scares me less because Bitcoin exists, because people always worry that AI is going to be controlled and like companies and corporations will control it and have ultimate control over the people. But I feel like that will also win because you know how things are built on top of Bitcoin, like Lightning. I think that AI will have to be incorporated into something like Bitcoin that can't be changed or manipulated or controlled by somebody with, you know, the most money. And it will be sort of this layer of truth for AI to not, so that we don't feel like, you know, Google has control of whatever we're told. You know what I mean? I don't know.
It's a very interesting thought. And I hadn't really thought about that much before, and I don't disagree with you. I mean, I do think that one of the things that's underrated in the whole Bitcoin network is that, yes, it's a sound money protocol, and yes, there are limited supply of them, and the first and best use case is obviously store of value, but it's also a truth protocol. I mean, this is the most secure, largest, immutable, you know, network in the world by, you know, orders of magnitude. And so if something is encoded in the network, you know, it's true. It's proven to be true. And so I think many people are maybe underestimating how important that is. I mean, because, I mean, how do we really know what objective truth is? I mean, you kind of don't. I mean, you know, we all kind of hone in on it through science, but and in many areas there is no objective truth because there's a lot of opinion and debate, but here we have a mathematical truth engine. And so I think there'll be very big implications coming out of that as well.
Yeah, it makes me feel like that hope that Bitcoin brings to all different aspects of our life, it just makes me feel less worried about AI. You know, I just feel like it really does feel that way to me.
Well, and the thing to keep in mind with AI is it's, you know, and robots, I mean, it's, you know, they're always programmed by humans and by individuals. And,
you know, but you don't want those individuals programming them to say, okay, we're selling this robot and they're all going to be in your home, but it's controlled by some.
I'm a bad actor. I get it. Yeah, no, yeah. I get it.
So it can't be like,
and I mean, as Saylor points out, you know, I mean, Bitcoin will become a weapon of war. I mean, in the sense that, you know, again, you know, it's objectively provable in a world where things won't necessarily be provable. You know, I mean,
yeah,
you know, we could have AI images of people, we'll have AI voices of people, you know, all this stuff. But if you can control something that's on a network that can be proven, well, then you can prove that you are you, so to speak.
Yes.
And that's it's kind of a theory, ethereal to think about it, but I think it's going to matter. I really think it's going to matter, but we're talking years out, so.
And we have these ideas and we have these feelings, but it's true. It's like the way that you can't actually picture how it's going to turn out, but you do have that feeling that it's, you know, that it's truth. So you know it's got to be good. You know it's going to
I
reshape
think
and
that's
people will
exactly
build.
right. That's exactly right. And looking backwards, we're all thinking, oh, we should have seen that. It was obvious. I mean, like the internet, the first big app of the internet, I thought, so the internet came out and everyone's sending emails, a few people are browsing, they're getting information, so on and so forth. The first big kind of winning app on the internet was eBay. And what was eBay? eBay was just a worldwide swap market. You know what I mean? You got old junk in your garage, you want to sell it, put it up for sale on eBay. And it was kind of like, it was such a, and it did really well. It was just such an ingenious idea. It was like, yeah, of course. I can go to my local, garage sale, but I can't do a worldwide garage sale. Well, eBay enabled you to do that. And so it's like things like that are going to happen with Bitcoin. They're going
Even
to.
when you think about how people thought that Netflix wouldn't be a thing in Blockbuster, but it's like we were so stuck in this idea that what we're used to and comfortable with, we couldn't imagine change. So it's like even when people used to have the hobby of buying CDs or buying records, like if people still buy records for, because it feels like just old school. But it's like when you used to go to the store and buy CDs, you felt like, well, what if I don't actually own the CD? What am I buying? Like you think that you're not buying a physical thing.
No, I
And that's
recall
the
very
same.
clearly going to Blockbuster multiple times to get, the latest release of the hottest series, right? And and then they
You
brought
felt
that
like
back.
you actually left the store with something in your hands. Like you had
Yes,
this idea that
correct.
it's physical. I have it. I own it. People used to have shelves full of video, like VHSs and,
Oh,
DVDs
absolutely.
and
I've still got a
Blu-rays.
very big CD. I love music, and so I've got an enormous CD collection that's just sitting there collecting dust.
And now
Apple
you
Music
have
has everything I
streaming.
need.
You've got Spotify where you can have every song ever created,
Exactly.
in your
I don't
phone,
need it anymore, but
But people couldn't think of that. And I think that's when you think about Bitcoin, you think, well, I'm not holding dollars in my hand. What's Bitcoin? It's like, well, it's the same idea as you watching a movie. You're still using it. You're still watching it. You're benefiting. You're just not actually holding it in your hands. And what's credit then in that case? Credit is just not a different protocol. It's not something you're holding your, hold your credit card, but.
Exactly. Well, and and you get into, like I say, when you get into these micro transactions, you could, in theory, we could all monetize ourselves, and there'll be a way, I think, eventually it'll get, the payment mechanisms will get easy enough and low enough cost that, like right now, if I want to read, if I want to read a Wall Street Journal article, I've got to subscribe to Wall Street Journal, pay them $40 a month, whatever it is. There should be a super easy swap mechanism where I can say, well, if I want to read that article and that article is 62 cents and all I got to do is send a Lightning transaction, fine, I'll pay 60. I don't want to pay the $40 a month, but I'll pay the 62 cents.
For that article,
Or, the same is true, like Major League Baseball. If I want to get Major League Baseball, on my home cable package, I got to pay a couple hundred bucks a year.
My husband is
Well,
so upset about that too.
or football. I mean, same deal. It's like, no, I don't really care about that, but damn it, I want to watch the Lions game, and I'd be happy to pay $7 for the Lions game, but they don't sell it that way. And it's just because all the, they haven't set up how they can't figure out how to collectively, sell it for a reasonable price and not have the fees charged. And it doesn't work yet. But I mean, in turn, I mean, probably, I mean, podcasts like this might get monetized where, I mean, would somebody pay a couple of cents to see a podcast? Probably they would, and so you'd make a little money, I'd make a little money, whatever it would be. But I mean, I think that, and in turn, there'd be really cool kind of crowdfunding aspects. And I mean, imagine a society where, let's say somebody does something really good, somebody commits an incredibly heroic act, right? And everybody sees it and hears about it. And then, the story is told that person's very poor. Well, it wouldn't imagine, there are 330 million people in this country. Well, what if everybody sent them a dime? Do you know what I mean? I mean, that adds up to, and that were easy to do. You were on Oster and you just saw me and said, gosh, I really approve of that kind of behavior. I'm going to send that guy a dime.
And
Well,
that is definitely a
right.
possible future that you could imagine, because young people today, I feel like they, they're on social media a lot. They see YouTube a lot. They see all these TikToks, but I feel like they appreciate truth and genuine humans.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the beautiful thing. So I've got three 20-year-olds. I'll just comment on that. I mean, the beautiful thing about this generation, Is that unlike, you know, the baby boomer generation, my generation, we kind of got out and the whole thing was, we were kind of programmed to like, you know, be high achievers and make money so you can buy a nice car, you know what I mean? And buy a nice house and live a good lifestyle. That was, mm-hmm. that was kind of the message from our parents. All right. So we followed the script, right? Mm-hmm. Well, my kids and it's beautiful the way it's happened. I mean, they have a much broader view of the world and they're kind of like, that's, you know, they don't want necessarily stuff. They don't necessarily want houses. They want cars. They're kind of like, Dad, I just want to live in a world that's a good world. I want to see a world that's fair. I want to, you know, they're concerned about everybody's well-being. Do you know what I mean? And that's
because it's more connection.
Yeah, because they're more connected, right? Because of all these social networks. And so for them, you know, it's just, I mean, your generation is going to be the hero generation that's going to save us from this monetary crisis. That's going to rebuild a society that's fairer. And you know, I think that group of people are, you know, your group, you know, your age group is going to be much more magnanimous about trying to make sure everybody's doing well, not just the people at the top. Mm-hmm. And that's really what the world needs. It's a beautiful thing. So,
and that's what I think when I think about Bitcoin, I feel like even though people talk about the supply dwindling and it being a finite supply, there will always be a redistribution of wealth in this system. So it's always going to be somebody selling at some sort of price because
Bitcoin is just a giant savings pool. That's all it is. And so you either decide, all right, I've got excess capital and I want to save knowing that it'll be worth more in the future. I'll buy Bitcoin or, you know, at some point I'm going to retire and maybe not have any kind of regular income, but I'll need to support my lifestyle. And so I'll slowly sell Bitcoin to
pay my bills.
Yeah. I'll just live off of it. But what's beautiful about it is knowing that whatever the stack I have is, I know that it's going to continue to appreciate in value, not depreciate in value.
Exactly.
I mean, the saddest thing that my generation has faced, I saw this a lot. I still see it today. I saw it with my dad is, you know, you work hard all your life and you save up a certain amount of money and that's your entire life effort. You don't get to do it over again. I mean, you're 60 or 70, you don't have the energy you had when you were 20 or 30. Right. Yep. And, you know, you retire or you decide to slow down and suddenly the money just doesn't buy as much. And my father, you know, retired with an okay sum of money. He should have been pretty comfortable for the rest of it. By the time he passed, it had really dwindled down to a much more modest amount because of all the inflation that takes place. You know, mm-hmm. I see 60 and 70 year olds who are afraid to retire, even though they have their house paid off and a decent, what most people would say, well, they're fairly well off. And they're like, well, maybe I'm not, because if I live to be 90 and inflation is really high, I'm going to run out of money, you know, and that's to me, that's really tragic. I mean,
why should you be working till you're 70 and literally still feel like you can't retire yet and can't take care of yourself the way you should? And, you know, it's like you're working till you pretty much, you feel like you're like working yourself to death, you know?
That's kind of what it is. And it's really kind of sad because, I mean, you know, I mean, I pointed out earlier, I mean, when COVID came along, you know, they grew the money supply 40% in 2 years, right? Mm-hmm. And so we more or less, COVID created about 40% inflation in the price of everything. I think so most people would agree their groceries have gone up by that amount. And, you know, so you're, you know, I know people like this. They've worked their whole life. They've saved. They've done the right thing, which is to save. Of course, I mean, in America, people don't think that's the right thing, but historically, it always has been the right thing. They built up a stack of money, whether it's 50 grand or a million if they did well. But it's some amount of money and that represents their entire life's effort. And then the government comes along, prints 40% of the money supply. They just stole 40% of that buying power. You know, they just stole
it. People don't understand that. I think people just don't understand that when they do that, it's when you think of supply and demand, when there's more dollars circulating, it takes more of those dollars to buy stuff.
Yeah. No, you're right. That's why people do not understand it. And again, you know, therefore the book and therefore your pie. I mean, this is what we're all fighting for. We're all fighting to end this. You know, we're fighting for a system that's fair, that ends this so that, you know, people can save money, do the right thing, save money, knowing that it will benefit them in the longer run and their life will get better.
Plus, we want also to make sure that when we do these things, when you write your book and when I'm doing what I'm doing, it's you want to make sure that because we know we're at this inflection point, this point that we feel like with technology, Bitcoin is growing faster than the internet. So I've heard that Bitcoin is like 1994 of the internet right now. That's how, what stage we're at, but it's growing faster. And the reason we want to spread the word and let people know is because we see what's going on. And, you know, it's very important that you wrote this book and that people understand the history and the hope. But just to see that we would like for more people that we care about and anybody who feels like they have been tired from working to death. You know, it's like you can slowly put, you know, I like the calculation, as much as you understand about Bitcoin, that's how much you should put into Bitcoin. Just if you don't understand much, put a little bit. If you understand a lot, put more. But I love that. And I think that we would love to see people get into it before the governments and the corporations and all of them collect monthly supply, and then you're buying it very expensive. So it's like, at least if you buy it now before they're all collecting it, you know, it'll be beneficial for you. You know, you always feel like you're buying it at a high price, but
this is one of those games where the early worm, I mean, the early bird gets the worm. I mean, it really, you know, I mean, Max Kaiser got a better worm than I got, and you know, But people who wait 10 years, they're going to pay more. And the benefits will always be there because it is going up forever. So it will always be the superior form of savings. And so savings are a good thing. But yes, obviously, the sooner you join the network, the sooner you begin to enjoy the benefits. And, you know, that's one of the other things I try to convey to non-coiners is just how, you know, how kind of peaceful it feels. Once you get to where you are, where I am, where you just totally get it, and you're all in, more or less, you know, it provides a sense of peace, you know, that in your mentally. I don't think most people fully understand how, you know, stressful and mentally taxing the rat race is. I mean, and, you know, when you're scrambling to always pay the bills and you got to work more hours, more jobs, you feel like you'll never get ahead. I mean, this is why people play the lottery, because it's the only thing that gives them hope. You know, they know it's a bad bet. You know, statistically, the lottery makes no sense. You're throwing the money away. But people do it because it's the only hope they have in their life. Instead, if they take that $10, you know, if they're using or 20 or whatever it is they use to play the lottery, instead, if they put it into Bitcoin, you know, they would, and watched it grow over time, they would be kind of, I think, pleasantly surprised with how much further ahead they'd get.
Because people don't realize that you can save money these days, you know, and I think you've forgotten that is not something.
Well, and they don't, the other thing people don't realize, very few people have an understanding of mathematical compounding. I mean, when I took my kids when they were much younger and I got out a finance calculator and I showed them, I said, look, you know, if you save $100 today and you grow it at 10% a year, you know, and you live to be 60 years old, it's going to be a big number. You know, the compounding savings compounded, you know, it's almost impossible not to get fairly well off if you do it, you know, assuming that you get the 10%, assuming you don't do stupid investments and lose the money. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it really is the way that, you know, if you look at, you know, kind of The Millionaire Next Door, which is a good book, you look at the way most of these people did it. They did it by savings and just investing in, you know, prudently. And over time, the value grew.
I have my cousin who, I thought this was crazy. She told me about how somebody had given her a $50 savings bond, like a treasury bond, when she was born. So in 1986. Yep. And do you know how much that treasury bond was worth today?
Well,
$54.
Right.
She made $4. So technically she lost money with all this inflation.
I was going to say, think about $50 when she was given that back in 84. You know, that would have bought her a lot more than the $54 buys you today. I mean, $54 today doesn't buy you much at all. So
yeah, like a tank of gas or something.
So yeah, that's a small trip to the grocery store. In fact, we all have different kind of grocery store trips. I mean, you used to have kind of the $20, $30 one. That's now become $60 or $70.
Yeah, just to get a couple.
And the big shop is, you know, $250 to $400, right? Or $300 at least.
Right.
If you want to buy a lot of protein. So
yeah, it's crazy. So it's like, just to think that her, like, thinking that treasury bonds, and that's what I think the rest of the world realizes too, like, are the US treasuries are not a good store of value. Like, they're not going to make money holding these things, you know? Yeah. So nobody wants it. No. So I don't know. This has been super great. If you want
go ahead.
If you want to finish out with anything else, I feel like
nothing in particular. I mean, obviously, I'm trying to sell books, but not because I make much money on each book. It's kind of ridiculous how much Amazon takes, but more because I'm really trying to spread the word. I mean, everyone has to have kind of a, you know, a razor or a core reason for, you know, for doing what they do. And my core reason for writing this book was I really wanted to try and make a statement, help as many people as I could, spread the word as much as I could, and leave an impact. Hopefully of shoving us in a direction toward sound money, because I think it'll make the world a better place. So, you know, the book, if you can just, you know, pass it on to friends, tell people to buy it, whatever. I mean, I think, you know, when you read it, when people read it, they get it. I mean, I've been told that it's working. So If that's the case, you know, the people who control the system, the monetary masters at the Fed, I mean, there are 12 that, you know, on the Fed board and more that support them, but, you know, and the bankers and all, I mean, you know, we outnumber them enormously. And, you know, so we need to get a large group of citizens that really understand this issue and that are pounding the table saying we've got to go to a sound money system based on Bitcoin. And then it will happen. And as it happens, the world will become a much better place. But, you know, we've got to have politicians who run on this issue. You know, they'll say, hey, you know, sound money is a key part of what I believe in. Because as the crisis or the problem unfolds here, you know, they're going to be competing sides. Some people are going to say, you know, no, that sound money stuff, that's bad. That's what's causing the problem. We got to tax it, you know, blah, blah, blah. But there'll be others who say, no, no, this is what we need to do to fix the broken system. And we need more of those people. And to get those people, everyone needs to understand it at a core level. And so the book was my attempt to help people to understand it at a core level. So, you know, I hope I'm going to measure the success of this book, not by how much Bitcoiners like it, because Bitcoiners like it. I mean, I get that. Yeah. I'm preaching to the choir, right? What I care about is, you know, how much normie spread can we get? Can we get it to go viral? Can we get somebody outside of the Bitcoin world to endorse it? Right. You know, can we get it to the point where it's on, you know, it's just more nationally known. And we got 330 million people in this country. Right. You know, I've sold, you know, 15,000 copies or something. That's great. It's going well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Sahil Bloom, a guy wrote a book called The Psychology of Money, Morgan Housel. The guy sold 7 million copies of that book. It's like, okay, you know, come on, guys. How do we get this word out there to everybody? That's right. You know, I'm all ears. And if anybody is in the media or has any ideas for how to, you know, get media appearances or push this, I mean, I've sent it to 60 Minutes. I've sent it everywhere, and I'm going to continue sending it everywhere in the hope that people that have media channels will read it, understand it, and say, this is something people should be aware of. So yeah. I'm all ears. If anyone wants to DM me on Twitter about suggestions to spread the word, that's what I'm trying to do.
I have some thoughts circling around in my head. So if I can,
Like I say, I'm all ears. You know, we gotta get it to be as broad. We gotta get the knowledge to be as broad as possible if we want to manifest this new better world based on sound money, which I think it's going to come either way. Okay. Right. I mean, even if I hadn't done this book, it would happen, but you know, my view is I'm running out of time. So I want to do it sooner rather than later.
You want to see it. You want to see it.
I want to see it while I'm still here to see it. Yeah. So
you want to see the world that you're helping build, you know?
I want to see the improvements happen. I want my kids to live in a better world. I mean, they're all doing fine, but you know, they can't buy a house. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah, you want to spread the word, and you want people who don't understand Bitcoin to understand that the system is rigged against us. Yes. And, you know, there is an answer.
This is our best way to fight back. Mm-hmm. You can protect yourself, fight back, and help bring about a better system. So,
yes.
That's all good. But
thank you.
Anyway, Stacey, I've really enjoyed being with you. Obviously, you really get it. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to do this again in the future. I have to hop off because I got another one come up here in a few minutes. I got to get ready for it. But
thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. I'm happy to share this. I'm going to let you know if I have any other ideas, and everyone can see. Let's share this book.
I'm all ears. So thanks again, Stacey. Really appreciate the platform.
Thank you.
Take care. We'll see you.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.